Jema, so we continue with the series on Srimad Bhagavat Puran, and we are not following a very strict chapter by chapter, but more or less it's flowing in that direction. So, but we are going a little ahead, sometime behind, because certain stories are just hinted but not developed. So stories are the most important part of these Puranas. And as we know that the same truth of the Vedas and the Upanishads has been presented in the form of stories. But there is a difference. And let me explain how it works. So if you read the Bhagavad Puran, you will see several places there is a description of Sri Krishna. But this description is not just, up above, but this description is also at the ground level. There is a connecting link between Sri Krishna, the avatar, and Sri Krishna in his original Swarupa. And there is a description of Sri Krishna from each person differently. For example, we read last time when Kunti describes, Sri Krishna is leaving. So she recounts the moments when Sri Krishna intervened and what Sri Krishna means to her in her life. Similarly, we will see that when Sri Krishna will go, and in fact all of them will go and meet Bhishma. So Bhishma will have his own narration. Then when Sri Krishna walks into Dwarka, all the different people will have their own narration, what they experience about Sri Krishna. Now this actually people don't realize, this is a meditation on Sri Krishna. So if you read the Bhagavad Puran, there is a whole chapter on meditation, ways of meditation. So it describes that, you meditate upon the gross body of the avatar. Then you meditate upon the subtle elements of the avatar. You meditate upon the qualities of the avatar. And then you go beyond into that which the avatar represents. So basically, knowingly, unknowingly, this is a smart thing which Rishi Vedavyas has done. And I wish, we had something like that for Sri Aurobindo and the mother. The only thing we have is 108 names of Sri Aurobindo. But a story presented in such a way that reading the story becomes meditation. That's how Ramayana has helped mankind. In India, just because in Ramayana there is several places that Sri Rama as the avatar of Vishnu is described. So by the time you finish, something of Sri Rama automatically enters into your consciousness. So same thing we find in the Bhagavad, but in a much more powerful way. Because it starts with description of Sri Krishna from different angles. It's like, you take the same camera, video camera, go around. So it's very beautiful. Those things we cannot really touch because one has to read them in original Sanskrit and then either the Hindi or the English translation. English translation doesn't really capture. To give one example. So when Sri Krishna walks into Dwarka, so there is a description first of his son, his brother and son, they all come to receive him. And how they look upon him, and then all the common people come. So Sri Krishna's quality is described there. So how does he describe? He doesn't say that, everybody he treats equally. So how does he treat everyone? So to some he did a namaste, to others he bowed down, to still others he came and gave an embrace, and to still others he just gave a smile, to other just an acknowledgement, and then it goes on to say that right down to the most downcast person, Sri Krishna goes and extends a hand of greeting. Now when you read it, it goes into your whole bones, blood and bones, that this is how greatness should be. So he is among the greatest of the great, and how he is dealing with each and everyone. Then when he goes into the palace, see, this is how the culture was being embedded, civilization was being built. And of course, Vedavyas knew that now that Sri Krishna has gone, there would be a deficiency of example. So he built an example. For example, when he goes to the palace actually, whom does he meet first? So he meets the different mothers. One is of course Devaki and Yashoda, but there are other mothers. And how he meets them, how he greets each one of them. And then he meets his wife, wives, 16,000 wives. So how would he meet them? So it's described that they were, while Krishna is away for a long period, they were spending in time in meditation, in various kinds of, you know, rituals which were prescribed, but rituals which are meant to keep yourself fully intact, knowing the way the world operates. And then when Shri Krishna walks in, each one of them feels so happy. They actually, he describes very briefly, they abandoned their puja and rituals, which is obvious that, you know, Shri Krishna is there. But abandoning your meditation was not considered something very good, but they abandoned it. And then Vyas described that the feelings they had towards Krishna was expressed as lajja. Means they blush actually when they see Krishna. Now you see, and to each one of them, Shri Krishna gives a glance and they feel fulfilled within. Now this is something amazing. I mean, everybody was so happy meeting Shri Krishna because he was a source of sweetness and giving himself freely and generously to everyone. So that's how it describes. And it's with each one the right measure, the right way. And mind you that he comes, he can be a king, but he refuses. He doesn't. Krishna never actually becomes the king coronate, neither when he outwise concert triumphs over him, kills him, nor when he comes to Dwarka. So he is shown as that kind of a renunciate inwardly. And it closes when Krishna's entry into Dwarka is described. So it closes with a very interesting remark. He says that there were many men and women that time who were very of a frivolous nature. And when they saw Krishna, they would never understand that he is inwardly nirlipt, detached. They felt he is like any other person and he is asakt over the women. That's how it describes. So when they saw him, they felt, oh, he is asakt towards us also. But it was not true at all. So Vyas puts it in perspective that looking at Krishna, one could never fathom who Krishna is and what Krishna is. So it's a beautiful reading. Obviously, we are largely focusing on the story, but just to put things in context. And just because we are speaking about it, because people often talk about historicity of Shri Krishna. So in the Mahabharata, in the Bhagavad Puran, in Harivansha and in Chandogya Upanishad, Krishna, son of Devaki, is mentioned. And these are four very authentic sources, and there are other also minor sources. So what is the difference between, say, Mahabharata and Puran before we go into anything further? So Mahabharata is itihas. Basically, it's a something which actually happened. It's a account of history. So in Mahabharata, you will not see many kinds of fantastic things happening. There won't be any devotional element in the Mahabharata. It's about a story as it is unfolded. Naturally, it's a narration of Vyas, though he is the first-hand person who is narrating it. He was involved in the Mahabharata itself. He is one of the characters. But yet, it's primarily history. That's how. History means iti, thus, has happened. That's how it happened. So it's history, historical narrative. So what about Puranas? So in Puranas, history is there, but subordinated to many other elements. So in Purana, there will be genealogy. Though in Shri Krishna's case, the genealogy is mainly given in Harivansh. So you will go back to Yadukul. So where does Yadukul start? Yadukul starts with one of the three sons of Yayati. Each of them is a fascinating story. So from there, Yadukul, and among them, there are different clans. You know, there are seven clans of Yadu. So when you read it, you understand. And each of them further, like, you know, what was the cross connections to the Ikshvaku clan, etc. So it'll contain genealogy. And Purana will also contain cosmology. So, you know, somewhere it will come, the origin of creation and the different gods and the different planes of existence, they will come in Puranas. So history is there, but it's subordinated to all other, many, many other elements. There are 10 or 11 elements, but we need not go into that. So that's how Purana are very, very rich. And Sri Aurobindo says its poetry and literature is extremely beautiful and rich. So I wish, you know, of course, people who know Sanskrit would enjoy it a lot more. But even just the narrative is very, very beautiful. So this is about the little background. Now we come back to where we had left on our fellow Ashwatthama. We had not finished. We are not done with him. So because his story contains a very, very interesting lesson. See, this is how Vyas has embedded lessons. He doesn't say, therefore we have to learn. This is the moral of the story. But if you read through the story, it becomes very obvious. So Ashwatthama is born of Dronacharya and Kripi, Who is Dronacharya? Dronacharya is son of a sage or a rishi, in fact, seer and an apsara. So this combination in several places we will find in throughout Indian story, the combination of a rishi and an apsara. So Drona is formed because Rishi Bharadwaj, he was a rishi, is credited with a lot of scientific developments, including Vimana Shastra and Ayurveda, many things. Rishi Bharadwaj is a really super scientist kind, like Da Vinci. You can compare him to that. So Rishi Bharadwaj and there you have a very interesting technological thing. So Rishi Bharadwaj is taking bath and he sees an apsara and he has a release of his seminal fluid. Now they knew the value of this. So he collects it in a dona. Dona is a, you know, made of leaves. You make it and he transmitted it into the apsara. So that's how she became the mother. So it's very amazing. And is it biologically possible? It's possible, actually. Before you talk about test tube babies, the seminal fluid can contain the biological unit of the man for even a, you know, hour, a few hours. So something is saying that, which is, one can say, one of the first IVF, if you want to put it like that. So he is born from that lineage. And then he learns all the weapons. He is a master himself. He is a Brahmin by caste. And Kripi, she is again Kripa, and Kripacharya and Kripi, they are both born from boon of Shiva. Their parents are again a rishi and an apsara. So both of them are very special beings. Who? Ashwatthama's parents. So Dronacharya and Kripi. And they have done a lot of penance. Now you see, read this story, the finer details. They have done a lot of penance to Lord Shiva. So after a lot of tapasya, ultimately Shiva grants them the boon. Okay, I'll send to your, to the womb, and I'll bless this baby who will be born of you. He'll contain something of my ansha. So he is one of the Rudra elements is there in Ashwatthama, and he's born with a gem of money. Now, what is the gem? Some people ask this, that how can it be that, you know, you are born with a gem? That's because our mind thinks gem means a real stone like that. Now, if you go into a stone formation, stones are basically fluids which crystallize. So they are crystals. So biologically, there are various kinds of fluids whose full role we do not know. For example, the spinal fluid. Now, spinal fluid, we say that, well, it's cushioning the spine and this thing. But if you go into yogic literature, spinal fluid is actually through which the nerve currents can pass, subtle nerves. So, you know, it's the where the subtle centers, they can actually open up. There is something corresponding to the spinal fluid. So all this fluid of the spinal fluid accumulates. Now I'm just saying that how we can look into these things. So it accumulates ultimately into the head and the brain, and that's how it spreads out. If you look at the spine and the brain, it's almost like a serpent. The cobra with a hood which is fanned out. So now, if you really see that, was there a way that this fluid was accumulated somewhere in the forehead and gave him special powers? Now, it's interesting that Ashwatthama didn't marry. And he was regarded as a Chiranjeevi. Now, this is exactly the process of yoga where the fluid, which is seminal fluid, is uplifted and raised and conserved and changes into the spiritual energy. So it's quite likely that Ashwatthama was blessed that way right from birth. And that's what made him an invincible warrior. Actually, nobody could defeat him. He was not immortal. Incidentally, he was not Chiranjeevi. Don't watch Amitabh Bachchan movies which show people searching for Ashwatthama all over the world. It's not mentioned. And if it was so, Krishna would never tell Arjun that you should kill him. That statement would be meaningless, because Krishna would have known that he is a immortal person. And Arjun would not promise equally to Draupadi that I am going to get Ashwatthama's head for you. So he was not immortal. Now, where does the immortality come? We'll come to that later. But just to touch a little more upon Ashwatthama. So he is born with that. His father gives him many weapons which are not really deserving. So he has used Brahmastra, but he had also another weapon which is called a Narayanastra, which his father didn't teach anyone, which is very biased, you know, I must say. He was extremely biased towards his son, and he gave him all the possible weapons. So there is a very little touching story in the Mahabharata that Arjun would notice it, that, you know, he is teaching. But Arjun didn't feel jealous or go, but he said, I want to be better and better. But he is not really blaming his teacher. So what he does is, he says there is one, like, you know, we talk about upgrading skills. So he says there is something I can learn which you cannot teach, but you can learn by your practice. So what was it that Arjun learned? He learned the art of archery at night. So not only he could shoot all that was known, Shabdabedi and all that, he could shoot accurately at night. A feat that came very handy, you know, post Abhimanyuvat. So there is, that was his capacity, that at night he was one warrior. That's why one of the names of Arjun is that one who has conquered sleep. So it didn't mean that, you know, that he never slept. No, he had conquered sleep means he could, if there be a need, he could go without sleep and he could participate in a war with full energy. So this where he learned things. Of course, later on he got the deadliest of weapon, Pashupati Astra. So just a little bit about these weapons which keep coming up. So Brahmastra. Now you see, Brahmastra is not given by praying to Brahma. His father teaches him. So what is it? Why it is called Brahmastra? So we see there are three types of energies, which in Sankhya and Yoga it's well known. The Sattva, Rajas, Tamas. And if you go to their source, these energies are operating everywhere in the cosmos. So Rajogun is the energy which creates. It's the energy which has gone into creation. So when you read about Brahmastra, like the description last time, if you read, so it shows up with a flash of intense light. It's a light that has the power, and it like blinds you and absorbs you. Light, if you keep intensifying like laser, what does it do? It can even cut holes through anything. So it's an intense light. And if you go back to creation, probably in physics also, that, you know, one of the first things that comes into the universe is light. Perhaps that's what is meant in the Bible. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. So light, and then comes sound. So light has the power to create. And there were ways and means by which this energy could be harnessed and released. That's what we see in the case of, and even brought back, you know, which is what we see in Brahmastra. What about Pashupatastra? Pashupatastra is the power of vibrations which can both create and destroy. As a weapon, it is the most devastating destructive weapon because it's the energy of destruction. That's why it is Shiva. So Pashupatastra is Shiva, who is the great destroyer, and the energy of destruction which exists in creation, that could be harnessed. So if you want to put it in modern language, the Brahmastra would be something like fusion bombs, and this would be something like fission bombs, like an atom bomb, Pashupati Astra, devastating, and which only Arjun had mastered. There is one more person, but Arjun had received it through tapasya. In Arjun's case, it was received by tapasya. And then there is Narayani Astra. So the third energy is the energy of preservation. Why? Because see, the description is so interesting. So Ashwatthama had Narayani Astra. And Narayani Astra went, if you read about the SAM missiles, I'm sorry to say compare, but you know, you'll see the description. So what happened? Narayani Astra, you shoot up and it becomes like a disc, and from there are constant arrows which are going. Now, what is the power of preservation? Power of preservation means it was targeted towards anything which is destructive in nature. It was like an anti-war something. So, if you fight it, it will destroy you. It will become more and more, intense. Meaning thereby, it could detect that here is somebody trying to hit back at me, somebody who is moving the maze, somebody who is shooting arrows. So it will automatically get focused and start destroying more and more. So the more you resisted, the more it became intense. And if you surrendered, it will not do anything. So you see the power of the preserver. It's Narayani Astra. So what does the preserver do? He balances. So the moment you see excessive destructive energies, preserver comes into balance. So it's so beautiful. So the energy of preservation which operates in the cosmos, so through tapasya, through various kinds of means, they had mastered it. Obviously, all that is lost now, but man is recovering them again, hopefully after learning the lessons of Mahabharata and the Bhagavad Puran, which is why we are talking about it. So, Narayani Astra, Ashwatthama uses. When does he use? He uses it very unjustly. Actually, when his father dies, he uses it. This weapon is not meant for destroying. It is meant that you have to, if there is an actual attack, you use this weapon. And everybody who is attacking, it will decimate. Because it's targeted toward the forces of war. But he uses, now when he uses, Sri Krishna sees and knows there is no way you can fight it out. Because the moment you try to fight it, you'll be destroyed. So there is a very interesting story that Sri Krishna tells everyone, bow down, bend down, surrender, surrender, surrender. He's shouting all over and everybody does it except Bhim. Bhim does not know surrender. So he takes his mace and he starts fighting. And the more he tries to fight, the more the arrows come. It's all described very interestingly. And then Sri Krishna jumps onto the chariot of Bhima and literally makes him bow down. He catches hold of his head and makes him bow down. And then the arrow, automatically they just pass away, fly away. They don't hurt anyone. Whatever who are killed are killed. And that's how. So it's very interesting. You see these three arrows, three systems, warfare, energies, power, which are born from the three kinds of energies. How they are tapped, what they are tapped is a different thing altogether. Mankind is just 4,000, 5,000 years in Mahabharata and it's already recovering. Shobhinda speaks of that in the Synthesis of Yoga. That man is recovering many of those sciences which man had lost. That's why you see rapidly sciences taking leaps. Because now that process has started. So this is about Ashwatthama. And then this money, which was the source of his energy. Because it was like accumulated energy, which was granted by Shiva. Sri Krishna asks Arjun to take it off. So Arjun takes it off. And he says, already he has lost this energy by the heinous crime that he has committed. Because he killed those sleeping children. And now taking off this money means all his energy will be lost. And then Sri Krishna tells him, you roam around and wander in this state for 3,000 years. According to Mahabharata, it's not there in the Bhagavad Puran. But in the Mahabharata, it is 3,000 years. So Ashwatthama is comfortably gone. Don't know need to search. Even that period is over. So the lesson is, number one, you may be born in a very good lineage. Brahmin, Rishi, all of that. Mother, celestial nymph, they are also heavenly beings, Apsara. They are not degraded beings. They are heavenly beings. You may be born as a blessing of the Shiva himself. You may be endowed with magical power since your birth. But your karma is your karma. This is the beauty. It catches upon you. So many people, because they sometimes ask this question. There are people who have prayed to mother because they have read it from, you know, sometimes people even say conscious childbirth. This is becoming a norm. So they, especially they prepare. So I caution them. All this is fine. But don't think your child is going to be immune from the law of karma. That child will come with his own destiny. You have given him a head start. It's like a person who is a very moneyed man gives a head start. And sometimes head starts can be also dangerous. Because the man may misuse it, and when he misuses it, and there are stories like that in the Mahabharata and Ramayana. But there are some cases where you don't have where you had a head start, but you used it well, like Markandeya Rishi, who is also given a similar boon from Shiva, but he conquers death. So this is one of the lessons. And the second lesson, which is interesting, that immortality, because people often say nowadays we are discovering ways and means to prolong life. So is this prolonging life not in the line of Sri Aurobindo? Sri Aurobindo says in Savitri, but immortality, it is said by death, but very relevantly, but immortality for the ignorant man, it will be a curse. Because if you have an immortal body with a consciousness which is animal-like, or that's why in Bhagavata also we'll read stories where people have strived for immortality. And that's why in Sri Aurobindo's yoga, he says very clearly, no physical immortality unless the consciousness changes. Without change of consciousness, without, you know, psychization, spiritualization, to start thinking that golden hairs are coming out of your head is probably all kinds of things happening except for the real change. So this is the second interesting lesson, that whatever be your background, your karma has the capacity to change it. So this is the second lesson of Ashwatthama, and now we are done with him. And now comes another very interesting character. Now after Ashwatthama and Kunti is this thing, they all go to meet Bhishma. And Shri Krishna says, ask Yudhishthira to learn from him. See, this is there even in the Ramayana. So when Ravan falls on the ground, Shri Ram asks Lakshman, learn statecraft from him. So he says from him, he says, yes, he looked after his people very well. So I often say, there is a president. I say, he's looking after his own people. And I see it's perfectly fine as long as you don't create, mess the whole world. It's a natural thing. So he says, no, he looked after his people very well. You ask him. So Lakshman goes and he learns. So same we see here. Now the moment a warrior falls, these were the norms. Either he falls on the battlefield, or if he surrenders, or if he dies, there is no enmity after that. You have to treat him like a friend, equal, learn whatever you can from him. That's why you see this norm was there even during the Trojan War. But it got broken, just like with Abhimanyu, they broke the norm. So in the Trojan War, we see that there is a whole canto dedicated, almost a canto, over the dead body of Patroclus, which is Achilles' nephew. After which Achilles jumps into the fray and he takes Hector and refuses to give the dead body. So the dead was to be treated with respect. You can't, after that do all kinds of things to a dead body. So with Dushasan, Bhima keeps his pratigya, but till he dies, after that, enmity gone. So similarly, Bhishma, of course, Bhishma had a soft corner always for Pandavas. So he goes and Bhishma says very interesting lessons of statecraft, which we can say are amazing, but to come to the story of Bhishma, which is also a very fascinating story. So Bhishma is one of the Vasus. So Vasus are elemental powers. So we have the five elemental energies. There is sun, there is moon. So all these, there are eight Vasus. So they are elemental powers which guard wealth, which obviously these energies are very beneficial to all life which is beginning upon earth, and out of these developing on earth, and out of these eight, their ringleader, boss, was a man called, Vasu. They are celestial beings, Vasu called Prabhas. So one day, now elemental energies, they start messing up sometimes, they lose their way and they start messing up with who else but Durvasa, if I remember right. And they are cursed. And they are cursed that you people are with one of the rishis. So yeah, Durvasa most likely. So they feel that we are big beings and, earthlings. But see, the rishi is always, you will see that the rishi has mastered these forces. So they go and trouble him, torment him. So the rishi gives them a curse. The curse is that you people will be born on earth. And you will understand what is it to become human. Now, what is it to become human is my. But within curses of rishis always contain a boon within. So this story unfolds and they go back and pray, and Ganga finally agrees. She says, I'll make sure that you people go back fast. Now you have to take birth. You have no choice. And because Prabhas was the ringleader, he tells him, you will be born on earth like all the other Vasus, but you will live a long life. And you will see all kinds of possible miseries. So all of them are born to King Shantanu and Ganga. We know that marriage takes place. And the only condition Ganga keeps is that don't question me. See, all these celestial beings, godlike beings, they have their way of looking and action which we cannot understand as earthlings unless we grow in yoga. So says you won't be able to understand what I'll do. Don't question me. I want freedom. So he says, yes, he doesn't understand what is going to happen next. So Ganga is wonderful. But every time a child is born, she goes and releases the child in the waters. So first time Shantanu sees, what kind of behavior is this? Now they are the Vasus. Ganga knows their background. So Ganga is actually liberating them. Like that story of Narad, where you get liberated. Sometimes we get so touched, oh, young death. We don't know. We don't know whether, you know, the person had to only go through this little period and then. So if you see it on the axis of the rebirth and the recycling, so it become very logically understandable, not a cause of grief. I mean, grief is due to attachment, that's different. So she keeps on releasing them. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Now Shantanu cannot, you know. So 8th child, so Shantanu says, excuse me, please tell me, what are you up to? So Ganga says, see, I told you, you didn't keep your promise. So now I'm handing over this child to you. Because he says, at least you leave one child for me. She says, okay, I'm handing over this child to you. And I'm going back. So she had taken this promise, so she goes back. So Shantanu is left with this child who will grow up into Bhishma. Now the interesting part is, after whole thing is over, the Mahabharata is over, so Bhishma is waiting for Uttarayan. Now this also Shobindu mentions passingly in essays on the Gita. And Shri Krishna speaks about it. There is a cyclic nature of time. So several places you will see Muhurta and all. Now people become too much into it and the divine overrules everything. But generally there are periods which are auspicious and periods where there is a... because in nature every kind of power is allowed, because they all have a place to in the creation. So when you read the description of Sri Krishna, one of the places, so it is said that Dharma is his chest and Adharma is on his back. You'll be reminded of a similar story in the Jewish tradition, where he caught the hind of God. So basically, not going into it, but that's where Adharma. So everything has been brought into creation with a purpose. So even darkest energies serve a purpose. So they serve a purpose to test us, our sincerity, make us strong, make us wise. They have their own role to play. So now coming back to Bhishma. So Bhishma is waiting for Uttarayan. So like in the morning, very simple observation. If you see that between spring to almost, September, you have many festivals which are connected with masculine gods. Now, come October or come September onwards, after Ganpati, you see the series of, there are Devi festivals. So you'll have Durga Puja, Lakshmi Puja, Kali Mata, and you'll have Saraswati Puja. And this is called as, just as this is known as Pitra Paksh, so after that Matra Paksh. So wherever there is this intense darkness, the Divine Mother becomes very active, because this is the period when, and Sri Aurobindo even says in Record of Yoga, one of his first records, that it is November month and it is Amavasya, very favorable for me because it's the day of Kali. So you see, the day of Lakshmi will be full moon day, because full moon is... Soma and delight, sweetness, and Amavasya is Kali's day. So similarly, morning time you'll see positive thoughts come very easily. Night is the time when the most positive person, I mean, unless you are established inside, suddenly you know all kinds of thoughts come. Strange. So there is an action of these energies which balance the flow of creation, and everybody has to pass through them. So Bhishma is waiting for Uttarayan. Uttarayan is basically after the Makar Sankranti, means sun is going into the ascendance. So more or less. So he is waiting. That period has come nearby. And that's the time when Bhishma says his version of Shri Krishna. So it's very interesting. So there are several places. As I said, each character is describing Krishna and how they perceive him. So Bhishma describes that, oh Krishna, I remember that moment when you broke your promise for the sake of your devotee, for Arjuna. And that's the story where Shri Krishna has promised that I'll not lift weapon, anything. I'll be unarmed, sitting, you can choose me or my entire army, Narayani Sena. So Arjun chooses Sri Krishna. This is immortalized in one of the aphorisms of Sri Aurobindo. He says that if on one side there be God and on the other side the entire world, choose the divine. So Arjun has made that choice. Duryodhan has asked for his Chaturangini Sena, Narayani Sena, which is very powerful. He thought he's invincible, but Krishna is on this side. So as in one of the days, I'm forgetting the day, Bhishma Parva comes much later. So, yes, it's in Bhishma Parva. So that day Bhishma has been told, oh, you are nothing, you are just favoring the Pandavas. So he gets very angry. And then he starts decimating everyone till Arjun is the only one who could probably, you know, to an extent stop. But he's unstoppable. So there comes a point when Sri Krishna notices that he is going to kill Arjun. And that's the time Sri Krishna jumps and he confronts him. And Bhishma describes, I broke his armor all over. His body was filled with all my arrows which pierced him. Now we understand why Bhishma has to sleep on the bed of arrows. So arrows had pierced him all over, just like it is happening to me. He says that. He says that pierced his unarmored body. You are not supposed to do that. With arrows all over and blood was dripping, just like, you know, I am lying on this couch. And that time I saw his that roop, which I still remember. He just lifted a wheel. And Bhishma is continuing to fire all the salvos, all the weapons. Now they don't go past Krishna after a while. And then he says, how come? And then Krishna says, I am the Lord of Lords. Nothing will pass through me. Now you see the beauty of this story. That whatever be the weapons, whatever it be, nothing can go past the Lord. There is a place where the mother speaks of this. That thou art the unsurpassable barrier against all excess of evil. If you have the divine protection, nothing can pass through. He will take it on himself. So in Mahabharata it is Sri Krishna. In Ramayana it is Sri Rama who puts Vibhishan on the side and takes the arrow of Ravan. So then he does pranam. He understands what he is up to. Now the interesting part is promises or no promise. This is a very beautiful bhajan. I can't help. I am reminded of it every time I narrate this story. This is a bhajan. I am forgetting his name. He says, I'll say in Hindi, then the English part. Prabal prem ke pale padkar Prabhu ko niyam badalte dekha. Apna maan tale tal jaye bhakt ka maan na talte dekha. He says, when divine takes care of his devotee, he loves him. And this, of course, a two-way process. Then he doesn't care. World will call him that you are a sea, you couldn't keep your promise. So he is telling a lesson also to Bhishma. Dharma is more important than promise. Whatever promise you may have made. That's why people cannot understand, you know, the action of Sri Krishna, of Sri Aurobindo. They cannot understand the action of Buddha who walks into. He says promises are okay. But no promise can be superior to dharma. So dharma, the demand of dharma is that as the Bhagavan, I have to protect my devotee come what may. People will say he broke the promise, doesn't matter. So he does that. Very touching bhajan. And it also shows that the power of bhakti, that, you know, when he takes charge of the bhakta, nothing can come, you know, nothing can really harm, nothing can. And Sri Aurobindo confirms this so many places. Unfortunately, we have turned Sri Aurobindo into a philosopher sitting up above, and he is so much full of that love, and, you know, he speaks so much. The mother's name is the ultimate protection. He speaks about all these things, which unfortunately in the, if I may use a technical word, discourse, Sri Aurobindo discourse never finds a place. Because we all start mapping supermind to mind when we don't even know our own mind. So anyway, so this is how the story goes, and he describes it. He describes many other things that I had recognized that he is the Lord, though I had forgotten on the battlefield, he reminded me again. But when he recognized, he says in the Rajasuya Yagya. So he reminds another episode. So in Rajasuya Yagya, when they go, when Yudhishthira is performing the Yagya, and everybody says that what will each one do? So Sri Krishna says, I lift up the, thrown away plates, I'll lift up those plates and wash them. So another, that you know, the divine, unblessed of the humble. He says, that time when I looked at him, I realized he's none else but the Supreme Being who has taken a human form. So you see, from different angles, Sri Krishna's Mahima is being told, which is beautiful than simply telling all the, you know, if you say I'm blessed of the humble, it doesn't make much sense. When you have a living example that what Sri Krishna did and Bhishma recount, then you understand, connect that Supreme, O thou who disdainest not the worm to be, nor even the clod, therefore we know by that humility that thou art God. So this is where he describes Krishna. And then he leaves his body. Now the story doesn't end here. So when Bhishma leaves the body, he has to, ideally, he should go back to his world, the elemental energies. So when he goes back, he is told, no, you are upgraded. So all the seven Vasus are back to their role. But Bhishma is upgraded. He has to go higher. So they ask, why? So it's not about his pratigya and all. Because he says, because you took a human birth. You see, I tell you, whatever, okay, gods are great. But your mother says, the most fragile, there is no creature most fragile than man and no creature more mighty than him. And that's why you see even the gods envy. It is said that to evolve, if a god wants to evolve, go beyond his limits, he has to take a human birth. So that's, the story of Bhishma is again a reminder that we don't realize that what it means to have a human birth. So this is about the Bhishma, and one last character today we can introduce, because all of them are going to go. And so the third character is Vidur. So Vidur is, as we know, he is born of a, when sage Vedavyas goes, and there was a process which was called Niyog. Now Niyog is a kind of samagam of a rishi with a woman, but with a purpose of, you know, giving birth to a progeny. Whether there was a physical act or not, but that's not so important detail. So his mother has requested him, Satyavati, and Vyas Rishi comes. We know the background, because her children cannot produce offsprings. So to keep the progeny and lineage, which was considered very important that point of time, so Rishi Vyas goes, and one of them is frightened. These are the three women whom he had got, Bhishma had got. One had gone away, and you know, Amba, and the other two are there. They are wedded to Vishitravirya. So one of them gets so afraid seeing him. So there is Pandu, who is, you know, born yellow and frightened with fear, pale. And the other, she closes her eyes because she cannot bear the intensity of sage Vyas, and there is the blind king who is born. Again, you know, the state of consciousness during conception. And then the third one, then two have gone, so he sends a Dasi. So Dasi goes, and Dasi is Dasi. For her, like, Rishi is wonderful. So, and it's a beautiful work. She is, you know, helping the kingdom. So out of her comes she does with all the devotion, because he knows he's this Rishi and he is going to bless me and bless everybody with the progeny. So out of Dasi comes Vidur. Now, just because we are talking of Dasi, see, this idea of caste and all this is so ridiculously absurd, which has come later on. It was a Varnavyavastha. It was not about birth. In the Mahabharata war, the sole survivor, most people believe Dhritarashtra had 100 children. He had 100 plus one. One son, the one and only one, was born from a Dasi. Because actually Gandhari couldn't produce a child. All the 100 children were test tube babies. But we'll not get into that. So then, but before the test tube babies, Dhritarashtra, for having a child, he had a Dasi with whom a child was born. That child is the sole survivor of the Mahabharata war, and his name is Yuyutsu. So he is famous because he crossed over from Kauravas to the Pandavas, because he knew that Dharma is on that side with Krishna. And he is not only the sole survivor, he looks after the parents, looks after the kingdom till, you know, Parikshit grows up. He is a wonderful person. So now Vidur is Dasiputra. But he is known as Dharmatma and an Anshavatar of none else but Yama, who is the guardian of Dharma. Now, there is an interesting story about his birth also. So, the story goes that there is a sage, Mandavya, again immortalized by Sri Aurobindo in a set of poems which are called as Meditations of Mandavya. I have been trying to restrain my urge to read. I'll read at the end, okay. So, Mandavya is a sage, and one day he is doing his tapasya, and there are two thieves who have broken into the king's palace, stolen things, and they are running away. And suddenly they realize that the people are behind them on their heels to catch them. So they throw the jewels by the side of sage Mandavya and hide nearby, thinking that now they will catch Mandavya. And sure enough, they catch him. And there are different versions of the story. According to one version, the two thieves are also slain. You know, it's very interesting because this two thieves slain by the side, it's there in Christ's story and it's there in Mandavya's story. So they are slain. But Mandavya is also, they throw the Trishul to kill him. But Mandavya is not killed. He remains in that state. So now, the king is surprised because they tell the king, we don't know, we did through the Trishul. Another version is where he was made to sleep on a bed of nails. But whatever it is, he survived what would normally kill. So the king comes and says, he recognizes sage Mandavya. He falls at his feet. Please forgive me. So now the sage says, why? He says, but I am the one who is responsible for this sentence to you. He says, who? Who are you? Who are you? He says, I am the king. He says, so what? He says, no, I am the one who gave the order. He says, you believe like that. Ultimately, nothing happens in the cosmos unless there is the will of the Lord and the deities who are guardians. So he can't understand that how come, I mean, he doesn't blame him. He doesn't even look at him. He says, you are nobody. You are just an insignificant little fellow who believes that you can have the capacity to shoot an arrow and get me killed. He says, you just go. Don't worry about it. And then where does he go? He goes to meet Dharmaraj or Yamaraj. So he says, why did you do this to me? So Yamaraj says, you know what, according to our records, there is, a computer says that, well, some lives back, as a child, you had tortured some of the insects. So you had to go through this torture. So now you see jurisprudence, so dharma, how they defined and understood dharma. So he says, okay, how old was the child? He says, 4-year-old. He says, don't you know that a 4-year-old child, a child below 5, is absolved of any misdeeds? So he says, I'm sorry. He says, see, catches him on a very legally technical point. He says, what you have done is a dharma. What I did as a child was a child. But what you have done is a dharma, so I am going to give you the punishment. See, what kind of rishis they were. They could challenge the law. There was nothing like an ineluctable karmic law as we, you know, keep on reading now in all kinds of WhatsApp version. Jaise karm ki hai, uska phal dega Bhagwan. First of all, Bhagwan doesn't come into the picture, by the way. In the karmic law mechanism, Bhagwan can cancel everything. That's how we see in Shri Krishna could cancel the laws. He could override the laws. He's not the one. He has made the law and somebody is the guardian because of the running of the world. But always, he can cancel. He can say, like even modern times, the president can pardon the criminal of the criminals. He can say, okay, I pardon. You can't put a plea, but sir, according to IPC so-and-so, he'll say, no, I have the right to pardon. So same thing, divine has not created the karmic law. This is a law which operates in the creation to keep the balance and help us in the evolutionary process. So it's described beautifully in Savitri at several places, but I am now resisting the temptation. So he says that, well, you have to be born as a human and understand what is it that humanity goes through. Again, and then get back and correct your books. He doesn't say that, but that's my version. So he says, okay, and you have to be born as a Shudra. Shudra here was the lowest of the lowest. So he is born as a Dasi Putra and he never gets really, he is the mantri because he is one of the sons, first brother, half brother of both Dhritarashtra and Pandu. So in a way he has an important role to play everywhere. And Vidur is Dharmanisht. He is regarded as, because there were two incarnations of Dharmaraj, that is Yamaraj in his mode of guardian of the law. One is Yudhishthir and the second is Vidur. And Vidur Niti, if you want to hear, it's very amazing. It's something so beautiful when it talks about people, how to manage statecraft. Amazing, but that's a different subject. But you can find, I'm sure, there would be things like Vidur Niti. Vidur Niti is believed to be the original version of what later came to be known as Chanakya Niti. Now it's time for Vidur also to depart because he has lived for 100 years. He has suffered all the things before him. So he says, now I also want to go. But nobody will let him go. So he is brought to the palace. And then what happens? He sees that his brother Dhritarashtra, he is day by day getting more and more attached. So he tells Dhritarashtra something very interesting. He says, you old fellow, you don't feel shame? So he says, what for? He says, you are eating with the hands of that Bhima who has killed all your sons. What kind of a shameless creature you are? He says, just because you want comfort, can you stoop so low? So when Dhritarashtra hears it, he understands that he's in his conscience awakens. I shouldn't be doing all this. I know, but I am too attached to comfort. He says, haven't you heard about Dharma? This is not your age for seeking comfort. See, so different from modern idea of, old age comfort. Old age was not meant for comfort. It was meant for seeking the Lord. Put all of yourself into the Lord because that's what it is meant for. You have had the experience of life and everything. So Vidur tells him, look here, let's go. Enough of Yudhishthir is a nice guy. He will keep taking care of you. Bhima is the head cook. You are eating every day. You want to commit more sins? He says, no. Please tell me a way. He says, come, we'll go and spend our remaining days in meditating upon the divine. We'll go to some ashram. See, it was such a nice way. All problems in the home come because old people want to continue controlling the daughter-in-law. Okay, in Indian context, they should just say, it's okay, now we have lived our life, you have your freedom. So, this is Indian culture, by the way, and not what people... So, they all, Dhritarashtra, Gandhari and Vidur, leave clandestinely. Because they know that if Yudhishthir comes to know, he is very loving, he will not let us go. Because he's already feeling burdened. He's a sattvic person, so he's feeling burdened that whatever it is, it's a kingdom I've won through a lot of bloodshed. So when he comes, wakes up in the morning and sees they have all gone. So he is very sad and he asks and, they are all very sad. And then he recollects how his uncle, Chacha Vidur, has saved him so many times during Lakshagriha. So he remembers all those things. And that time Shukdev comes and he says, you should not lament. He says, where have they gone? He says, Narad comes. So Narad says that they have gone because this is their age to do vanaprastha. Now you see, from where did the idea of Vridhashram come? Vridhashram was not meant to abandon the parents. This is a wrong concept. It's not old age home. But the idea was that, that's a time when you should get rid of all the asakti. So they went, the thing was that there are things you just have to do it forcibly. Otherwise you'll be tight. I have seen old people getting so attached to television. Because, and children also feel that they are doing something very nice and they are clicking channels while they would be telling their, grandchild not to do it. They are terribly attached. So that's the time to cut attachment and you do it forcibly. So it was any ashram one could go, spend time there. It was part of the culture. It was understood. Not like, they go and in an old age home where they are shivering and all this. This was not the idea. Idea was create an atmosphere where they can be prepare themselves for the higher life. So we had our own version of old age, not home exactly, but something like along those lines, so that when you are away, you obviously your mind gets detached, you learn to have a common kitchen and you know whatever is being prepared, and there would be lectures. So there is a brief description of Dhritarashtra being there, and you know they hear all the rishis are passing by, so because they are staying there, they hear all those wonderful things and their mind slowly gets connected with the Lord Sri Hari. And then as destiny have it, there is a fire which catches, and Dhritarashtra first gets burnt and in the fire, and then his wife, knowing about it, she goes into the fire, in that fire which has come up accidentally. And seeing that, Vidur also decide that he'll walk into the fire. And thus ends the whole generation. Bhishma goes away, all these go away. But there is something else. The Pandavas are left. And what happens to them? What about Parikshit? How does he start the kingdom? What about Krishna? So all this comes in the next chapter. So we'll continue this next Tuesday. Thank you. Jai Maa.